Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Julie Oringer. Her latest novel is The Flight Portfolio, published in May by Knopf. Julie is the winner of many literary prizes, too numerous to mention. Her stories have appeared in the Paris Review, McSweeney's, Plowshare, the Pushcart Prize Anthology, and tons of others. She's written The Invisible Bridge, How to Breathe Underwater, and now The Flight Portfolio. The Flight Portfolio is a story that most of us may never have heard of. Varian Fry, with $3,000 in 3 weeks, which stretched to 13 months, and a list of Jewish writers and artists, obtained amazing results in saving Jews from Nazis and the Vichy government in Marseille. He fought amongst, in addition to those forces, Cordell Hull, to an extent Fullerton, the lackadaisical and anti-Semitic American government, as well as the American people, and the French puppet government in obtaining visas, false and forged, and surreptitiously spirited some of the best minds of Europe to freedom. This book gives us Varian Fry as he was and adds to his character an inside look at what might have been his psyche, his sexual orientation, and his thoughts. The book reminds us of what we must remember and, in my opinion, are rapidly losing. So welcome, Julie, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, and thanks for that excellent synopsis of the book and of the book's aims.
Thank you. So the question you're always asking is, coincidentally, I read Surrender on Demand like 10 years ago really thought. So how did you come across Varian?
I came across Surrender on Demand when I was researching my previous novel, The Invisible Bridge. I was reading about Herschel Greenspan, who was the young Polish-German-Jewish boy who, at the age of 17, walked into the German embassy in November of 1938 and shot a member of the ambassadorial staff in protest against his parents' deportation from Germany. And he was the first person to be extradited under this clause of the Franco-German armistice called the Surrender on Demand Clause. And so when I Googled that phrase, up came this memoir by Varian Fry. I'd never heard his name before, not in all my years of Hebrew schooling, nor in my years of the study of history. And I learned that here was the person who had, not single-handedly, but with some vital help, saved Marc Chagall and Hannah Arendt and Max Ernst and André Breton and Jacqueline Mamba and a whole host of others, who then were instrumental in shaping the art of the second half of the 20th century. And originally I thought, oh, this person's story must be at least an important footnote in The Invisible Bridge. But then the more I read, the more I understood that he really needed his own story, and in fact, he needed his own novel.
You know, one thing that struck me, and I'm sure you thought about it too, is those that he tried to save either committed suicide, as you explain in the book, or their papers didn't work and they were turned back, and then they eventually ended up in Dachau or somewhere else. Did you think about what the world might be like now if those people had been saved?
Yes, of course. I mean, it's impossible to read Benjamin, for example, without thinking what he might have written about the second half of the 20th century. I think that this was something that plagued Varian Fry, too. He was only in France for 13 months. And after he came back, he was at pains to try to both convince the American people and the American government just how bad things had been. And he was also keen to tell his own story and to sort of highlight the frustrations he had faced. And among them were not just resistance from the French government, but the other one you mentioned, which was that, our own State Department was resistant to the admission of these refugees. So so I think that for years afterward, he thought about what more he might have done and what more we might have done to save these people whose works could have, you know, illuminated the rest of our century in a way that would have been necessary and important.
You know, I listened to the interview on YouTube, the long one, and I read some other interviews, and of course I read the letters to the Times. But in an open-ended question, in that interview or in a different interview, he talks through another voice about how it takes courage, and he never knew whether or not he had that courage. So why did this guy do it? Why did he do it? You know, I know he was in Germany in 1935 and saw the atrocities, but what was it that made him in 1940 decide that he was going to do it with very little resources and very little support?
Well, you know, he had a personal history of taking action where he felt action was necessary. Even when he was a kid, he quit Hotchkiss boarding school because he felt that their hazing rituals were cruel, and he wanted to sort of mount a personal protest. And when he found the politics of the administration at Harvard to be objectionable when he was a student there, he planted a for sale sign on the dean's lawn, which nearly got him expelled. He would have been expelled had it not been for the action of his friends, who wrote many letters on his behalf to try to get him back in. It wasn't new to him to believe that he had to spring into personal action in order to right some wrong that he encountered in the world. So despite the fact that he had never done refugee relief work of any kind and had never helped to carry out illegal immigration activities, this wasn't a set of behaviors that was foreign to him. And the fact that he knew so much about Europe and had such a prescient sense for the way that the political situation was going to continue to devolve there, I think put extra pressure upon that part of his character that preferred action to commentary. And then if we look further, I think that there may have been personal reasons too. I mean, what we understand about him and what his son has also illuminated for us fairly recently is that, you know, he knew that he was gay, and this was always something that had been both a matter of course for him in a way, because he had been having relationships with other young men from a pretty early age, but that was also highly problematic for him. He was married twice and had three children. And felt that he had to observe some fairly conformist modes of life in order to live professionally the way he wanted to live. And so I think he probably grew up with a sense of otherness, a sense of his own difference, and not just of difference, but of the impossibility of living the way he might have preferred to live. And so without drawing too straight a parallel, I think he might have been emotionally sensitized to the plight of anybody else who was suffering under oppression.
Well, so since you bring it up, why don't we get to it, which is the question you're always asked. You know, you have a New York Times review, you have all these letters that come in, including his son's, but you have a woman who's written a biography and vehemently denies that you've established that he was, or why would you include this in him, in the book? And why don't you go ahead and explain what resources you used to actually find out that you were right?
Well, in fact, when I thought about this book first in 2007 and started reading about Varian Fry's history and about the people he was hanging out with, I very quickly encountered a number of instances of descriptions of his relationships with other men. And so my idea was that I wanted to highlight the moral difficulty of his situation, of his need to choose whom to save given his limited time and resources. And I figured that there would have been emotional factors that played into those decisions. If those emotional factors had been linked to his personal life and to his love life in some way, I knew that those linkages were likely to have been to men, because there had been so many stories about those relationships in the research that I had access to. Now, I think that there were some documents that I had access to that the biographer who wrote into the Times didn't, because Stefan Hessel's memoir, for example, The Power of Indignation, was published in English in 2011, and that postdated Sheila Eisenberg's biography by some 10 years, I believe. But there were plenty of accounts that could have illuminated the situation more clearly for her had she had access to them. Martin Duberman's biography of Lincoln Kirstein, for example, goes into detail about Kirstein's relationship with Berrien while they were at Harvard. So for me, the letter from James Fry stating under no, you know, with no uncertainty that his father had been gay and that this was something he'd known for many years was only a confirmation of something that I had seen written about in many places. I think that the difficulty for maybe for writers and readers of an older generation is that, you know, the ethos of the time was that to be gay was to be deviant, was to live a life that was, you know, that somehow was suggestive of pathology. And when I spoke to James Fry about his interactions with Sheila Eisenberg, the biographer who protested the idea that Berrien was gay, he said, you know, she wanted to present a very idealized version of my father, and didn't want to portray any element of complication, not that his being gay would necessarily be that. But I think that there is some, maybe there's some reluctance to get too deep into what really motivates the complications of what really motivates a person. And I'm not exactly sure why that would be the case. I mean, I feel like in Berrien Frye's case, you know, he has this, despite the fact that his name is not as well known as I wish it were, he does have this marvelous status of having saved so many people and, you know, being the first to be named by Yad Vashem as righteous among nations in the United States. And then for that person, for us to understand that person, not just as a hero, but as a gay hero, might have been complicated for some people, you know, in the decades even directly preceding this one, which is kind of astonishing to me, but it, but it's something that I've been coming to understand. So my hope is that now that we have clearer confirmation of this in the form of James Fry's letter, we can at least begin to put the idea of any debate aside and think instead about how personal experience shapes our willingness to act in the world, and also that we can actually, you know, celebrate this person as a gay hero, which I feel is far belated.
Okay, one more question, and I'll let it go, because I don't think it's that important myself. Were you surprised at the, I don't know, ferocity of the response and the letters that came in? Did you expect something?
You know,
go ahead.
I was truly gratified to see Andrew Sean Greer's marvelous letter, which I thought did such a beautiful job of illuminating what it is that the novel can do, which is to take histories that might have been forgotten or suppressed and bring them to light through the force of the imagination. And I think we cannot forget that kind of superpower of this literary form, even when it's a novel that has such a close link to history. I do feel like people get very entrenched about any hero who's connected to the Holocaust, and I understand why that territory is so sensitive. I mean, I come from a family of Holocaust survivors and survivors of other conflicts. You know, my mom's family came here after the 1956 revolution in Hungary. And so all my life I have been hearing about the importance of preserving history and of not allowing it to be repeated. But as a number of readers pointed out to me, and this was something that I thought about a lot myself, gay people were among those persecuted during the Holocaust. And so I think part of the vehement defense of what I did in the flight portfolio was with sort of fueled by that desire that gay histories not be forgotten, despite the fact that it may be complicating or inconvenient to some people to do that.
Yeah, now it goes back to the Spanish Inquisition or before. okay, we're done with that. obviously, I read, you know, Lincoln Kirstein's, you know, story about their relationship. What about Grant? Was there a Grant? Who is Grant? And, you know, the idea of searching for this young child prodigy. How far did you go afield from what that true relationship might have been, if you did?
I did go afield from that relationship because I felt that I wanted a character who would have been plausibly continuing in Varian's life from an earlier time to the present day. And part of the reason for that, I think, was that I was sort of thinking continuously about his character, you know, and just thinking about the formation of self and how we come to be who we are. And it occurred to me that it would be pretty interesting to think about how he had posited himself as a human being in college, how he had lived as this, you know, editor of a literary magazine and somebody who was highly active in Harvard's and Boston's gay scene at the time, and yet somebody who had also felt compelled to choose a more conventional life. And so I thought it would be interesting to problematize that element of his life and to explore it in a way that the historical record might not have captured by creating a character who had been present to witness it and who was present again in his life now. No real analog for that person existed. And so that was where I exercised the novelist prerogative and allowed somebody to play not just a narrative role, but also a psychological role in Varian Fry's real history.
And, you know, what's so interesting and was so poignant was that a bicycle trip to Arles and the storm and the mud and then the bellboy and all that. And it's funny because that's the part that really was fictionalized, and it really was. And the funny thing is that brought home who this man might have really been and the feelings he might have had. So granted, yeah, you extrapolated, you kind of, you know, you created this guy. But in that scene, I felt most poignantly and most connected to him, which is interesting, isn't it?
Well, I really appreciate your saying that. I think that's one of the things that I've loved in novels that have illuminated histories. You know, I mean, I love, you know, Prince Andrei and War and Peace on the battlefield trying to figure out how to act or staring at the sky after, you know, he's been wounded. Those moments where we're kind of viscerally immersed in a fictional character's experience of some real event. So thank you for mentioning that. I'm really glad that those sections were having that effect for you.
You know, another thing that was, it's close to me, wouldn't be close to anybody else, is my parents, my grandparents too, survived in Belarus, in Vitebsk, the pogroms and then World War I and then World War II. My grandfather got over, tried to bring his family over, but they wouldn't come, just like the Chagalls were reluctant. And Vitebsk was the childhood home of Marc Chagall. So that painting of my village with the houses and the upside-down cows and all that, that's my grandfather's street. That's where he lived.
Oh, that's amazing.
I know.
That's
and amazing. I've always loved that painting, even before I knew who where it was. I always just was felt really close to it. So,
that's funny. I felt a real connection with that image too, and I feel like all of us who grew up with, you know, close-knit Jewish families who told stories about their histories, felt in a way like that was their town, whether it was or not, you know.
Yeah, it's true. And then he leaves for Paris. And then that story was also fascinating. And he and his wife's reluctance to go, and what I was asking about before is what would the world be like? You know, you wouldn't have the stained glass windows that you had he decided to stay. And
that's right.
That's just one little thing. And
that
was also poignant because, you know, you just think about, again, how he had to make the choices. Oh, so let's talk about his assistants, who are so hilarious, I mean, not hilarious, but so lively and exuberant, and, you know, how she flew her plane across. Just tell about each of his three or four assistants.
Yeah, it was so exciting to read about these big personalities and how they'd become involved in his organization. So the person who you were referring to at the plane was Mary Jane Gold, who was an American heiress who hailed from Chicago, who had gone to Europe for finishing school in Italy and had stayed and had, you know, taken up a kind of glittering life where she would fly her plane from one Mediterranean playground to another. But when the war began, she became very sort of politically engaged. And she, first of all, she gave her plane to the French so that they could use it for their war efforts before the occupation, obviously. And then she and a friend of hers, Miriam Davenport, went down to Marseille after the occupation of Paris with a number of writers and artists. Now, Miriam Davenport, who is somebody else who became very important to the Emergency Rescue Committee, had been a student of art history and had studied at the Sorbonne. And one of the roles she played for the organization was a kind of artistic arbiter who would take a look at the work of some of the visual artists who were applying for aid and help Marion to determine whether or not they actually merited the attentions of the committee, which had this very strict mandate to help only the best. And of course, that was a mandate that became increasingly contravened as the work there in Marseille in 1940 and 41 went on. But Mary Jane and Miriam continued to be very close friends. And as Mary Jane got more and more deeply invested in the organization, emotionally and politically speaking, she also made huge financial investments in the Emergency Rescue Committee, which really helped to keep them afloat at a time when they would have found it increasingly difficult to expand the work. And she also helped to recruit donations from Peggy Guggenheim, whose funds were especially important at a time when the French branch of the organization was increasingly at odds with the American branch. And then there was Danny Benedict, who had worked at a police prefecture in Paris, and so who knew the kind of inner workings of the French official side of things. And there was the marvelous Albert Hirschman, who later became an economist, one of whose kind of guiding principles was the importance of failure. And so he dauntlessly figured out how to overcome the legal obstacles to their clients' emigration by pursuing all these black market channels that resulted in false passports and false passport stamps and people stowing away on ships and, basically doing anything they could to get out despite the limitations that the laws might impose. And those were just a few of the people who helped Barry and Fry. There were so many others, and I just, at a certain point, I realized that if I wrote about everyone, my book would be, 2,000 pages long. So I had to stop. But at the end, in my author's note, I write about a few of the others who were helpful to him, and especially a few of the other works about this time, the nonfiction books about this time in Marseille, which go into much greater detail about some of the other people who are instrumental to this organization.
The two things that I thought of was his the two male assistants reminded me of Perry Mason's assistant. I've forgotten the name of the guy who always did the legwork. And yeah, it was so funny. And then the other thing, which you've told before, but you didn't tell yet now, is how if they didn't have their artwork with them, if they didn't have their sketches, she would say, go down to the quay or the wharf and do some sketches and bring them back to me.
Yeah. I mean, can you imagine the pressure of that from both sides? Both
no.
On the side of being the artist who had to actually go down and produce this work that might or might not be a ticket to freedom, and then being the person who had to look at that work and make that determination. I mean, it's just too much.
Yeah.
And they knew it was too much. They knew that it was wrong. They knew that you know, the only solution was to make the strongest bid for more time and to raise as much money as possible. So that it would become less and less necessary to make those determinations.
Yeah, and that's the other thing, is that, you know, they're looking for intellectuals, they're looking for artists, they're looking for writers. And it reminds me of how people get upset because, like, Steve Jobs needed a liver transplant, and he was jumped ahead of all these other work people who needed a liver transplant. And some people say, well, yeah, he deserves it because look who he is. And there's the same kind
right.
of feeling a little bit here. What about all the people that didn't get on the list because they weren't smart, they weren't artistic, they didn't have that aesthetic?
Right.
But you can only save so many.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, but you can only save so many.
Yeah, I mean, that temporal and financial limitation was a real thing. But this is actually one of the core questions, I think, that drove the writing of the book and that sustained my desire to pursue it, even though it took almost 10 years to write. There's a narrative at the core of the book that is connected to Elliot Grant, the fictional character, where he asked Varian for help in saving the son of a dear friend of his, who is this young physics prodigy, but not too much is known about this person. And so the choice that Varian has to make is between saving this boy who appears to have this incredibly bright future and saving a very well-established visual artist who is this incredibly expressive muralist. And I think what I was trying to do there was to simply make concrete and specific and immediate the much larger dilemma that he faced continually during his time in Marseille and that plagued him afterwards.
The one part of the book that I was, I have to admit, incredulous about was how was he able to fight successfully the Vichy government? I mean, these refugees were out his doors and down the stairs, so they knew what was going on, and then they'd call him down and talk to him. Why wasn't he simply booted out of the country there then, or arrested? I mean, the Germans did control France through this proxy government. So why was
right.
he given this leniency? I didn't understand it.
Well, it's really interesting. I mean, that was one of the chief questions that I had as I was learning more about his story. I wondered the very same thing. Why was he allowed to do what he was for as long as he was? And one of the answers that emerged, not having to do as much with the French government, but in connection with our State Department's view of him, was that I think they believed him at first to be totally ineffectual. They didn't think that he was going to have anything like the success that he had. They knew he had no experience. They knew he had few contacts. And I think they believed that he was going to be a failure and that his presence there in France was not going to be damaging to their larger mission. And from the French side, I think that what he was doing had a couple of advantages. First of all, it was kind of aggregating refugees in a place that that would be convenient for them to be rounded up should the French government decide that it wanted to do that. But it seemed that the French government was somewhat ambivalent in its relationship with Germany, and it really wasn't until a little bit later that it became deeply, deeply invested in collaborating as much as it possibly could and rounding people up and hauling them away. I think for Germany as well, there was this this sense that they weren't sure whether they just wanted these people out or whether they wanted to punish them. And so there wasn't as much urgency in 1940 and 41 about rounding people up and killing them as there might have been a few years later.
Well, I guess it's, I don't know, here you go. Tell the story about the gentleman who was spirited out, was so happy that he decided to give the whole story to the newspaper. Fullerton gets it, and then what Fullerton does and how Varian is so happy that he can defenestrate those things, and then the gendarme who came up the stairs, which I've almost always...
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah. This is the story of the writer Leon Furstwanger, who was one of those who got out over the border. He was escorted over the border by this gentleman named Leon Ball, and was also helped by a German refugee's name was Lisa Fidko, and her husband. And he talked about getting his false papers, and he talked about how Varian's operation worked in Marseille. And he gave a very thinly veiled account to the New York Times, so thinly veiled that anybody would have known exactly who he was talking about if they had any knowledge of what was going on the ground in Marseille. And so this caused well, we don't know exactly what the causality was, but we think that there was that contributed to the shutting down of the Spanish border very shortly after the article was published, and also of an intensification of the pressure on Varian, both from the French government and from our side. In the novel, there's a lot of speculation as to why Furstwanger would have felt so compelled to tell his story. And it's amazing to think about just how different it would have felt to be embroiled in the situation and then to suddenly be in the States and to be in a position of safety. And I think that he really thought that he was doing something important. I think he thought that he was really illuminating the situation for the American people and for anybody here who cared to listen. Not in a self-aggrandizing way, but just in a way that would suggest how bad things had been. But I think he just didn't realize the extent to which doing that was actually going to put others at risk. So that scene that you mentioned in the novel involves, our conflict wanting to bring Varian in and hold him accountable for what had happened. He just doesn't want to hear about it. He doesn't want this to have happened. He throws all these notes from Fullerton out the window, and he refuses the summons. And what he does in the book is what he did afterwards for a few days in real life. After this came out, he just lay low for a few days. He split town with Stefan Hessel and just sort of hoped that the attention of the consulate would turn elsewhere. And fortunately for so many of the client rescues that followed, it did, partly for the reason I mentioned, which was that people were not yet at that time getting out in droves, and so I think they just felt like he was a sort of controlled threat.
I like how each message was more and more strident. He keeps throwing them out the window, and then the gendarme comes up and he thinks, you know, okay, this is it, this is the end, and he gives him a ticket for littering.
Yeah,
that's
hilarious.
Right.
Thank you. That was pure invention.
Oh, that was good though. I wasn't sure whether it was or not. So, you know, it's kind of, it is sad that after he left, you know, his life was, he was tragically cut short, in my opinion, you know, at 59. So he comes back to the United States and when he comes back, he tries to wake people up again. And it must have been so frustrating for him, as it was for so many people that came back from Germany, trying to tell America what was going on.
Yeah, that's right. He wrote a number of articles, both for The Times and The New Republic, and he gave a number of public lectures, and he spoke about what he had seen on the ground in France, both in his visits to the concentration camps and just, you know, through observing daily life in Marseille. And I think he found a lot of resistance once he came back here, not only during the war, but after it. His memoir was published in 1945. And when you look at the revisions between the manuscript drafts and the draft that was actually published, you see this effort on the part of his editor to not make the United States look so bad, because I think that at that particular moment, at 1945, when the book was published, we didn't want to hear about how our government could have done more. We didn't want to hear about the horrific effects of our shutdown border policies at the time. We wanted to sort of follow the triumphant narrative of our role in the war. But I think that disparity really plagued him. And, you know, you mentioned the fact that he died quite early at 59. When he was discovered in his room after he had died, he was discovered to actually have been in the process of revising his memoirs. So even then, at the end of his life, he was under this compulsion to retell the story in a way that I think would have been more truthful, even if it had been more difficult.
When you go to your website and you so graciously put, you know, you can look at the letters that he wrote to Eileen, you can look at the letters that, the letter he wrote to Eleanor Roosevelt, he seems like one of those guys, unlike me, who had more than 24 hours in a day. I don't know how he did all he did. It's just phenomenal.
Yeah, I think he was I don't think he slept that much. I think he just was operating under this very strong compulsion to do what he did. But yeah, I mean, I'm glad you mentioned those documents, because one of the things that was so helpful to the writing of this book was this incredible archive that's held up at the Manuscripts and Rare Books Library at Columbia. Anybody can go up there and request those boxes and take a look through his papers. But because that's kind of a difficult thing to do, and those papers are not digitized, I asked his son if it would be okay for me to put some of those materials online so people could actually read his unfiltered account of some of the events that are described in the book. So among other things that are there is this marvelous letter to his wife about this time when Maréchal Pétain was going to come to town, to Marseille, for a few days' visit. And so in advance of this visit, all the undesirables in town were rounded up and imprisoned so that the town would sort of look cleaner and tidier in a certain way, politically speaking. So Varian and his clients were arrested at the villa where they were staying outside of town and were taken to the police prefecture, not told what was happening, and then a little bit later were taken to a ship that was sitting in the port of Marseille and were essentially imprisoned on this ship for a few days while, you know, Maréchal Pétain was in town. He writes in beautiful detail about what that experience was like. So if you go to, you know, julieoringer.com and go to the Flight Portfolios page, there's a link that you can click on that's called Documents, and you can actually download a PDF of that letter and, you know, take a look at what his moment-by-moment experience of that imprisonment was like. And that really is, that's thanks to James Frye's desire that his father's papers be made more widely available.
You think, you know, I was thinking about the letter to Eileen. Was what you wrote about, it seemed like, well, the way you wrote it, it seemed as if they had an open or semi-open marriage, both with her actions and his. Was that, do you think that was really true? Did you?
Yeah. When I was reading those letters at Columbia, I was surprised by how lightly they seemed to, and how openly they seemed to talk about the possibility of his having affairs in Marseille and her having some while she was back at home. The one thing that she expressed trepidation about was the idea that he would become involved with a man. She wrote to him that she felt like this would be a terrible mistake for him, that it was the one thing that she really feared. So she obviously knew that this was a part of his life. And I felt like the truly open intellectual relationship they had would have naturally admitted a knowledge of that element of his character as well, you know?
Yeah.
So I absolutely wanted that to be a part of the novel because I felt like it was a more accurate representation of their marriage than some idealized or simplified version that had them, you know, that had him simply feeling like he was engaging in some betrayal that would have been, you know, a horror to her.
You know, going back a bit, it was really nice and really well done the way you made his two women assistants, if you will, without describing them, you made them very attractive. I felt they were both physically attractive, but you didn't really come right out and say it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, I think that they were both really vibrant personalities. And so maybe that's what you're reading, or at least I would hope so. They certainly had a pretty easy time recruiting the admiration of French legionnaires and other men around town. And so, yeah, I think they were sort of these beautiful, shining women who had this incredible life-saving role in his organization. So they were actually beautiful. They were constitutionally beautiful, you know, completely apart from their physical beauty.
Oh, I'll have to look and see if I can find photographs of them.
They are beautiful. When you look at the photos of them, they are sort of transcendently beautiful.
Okay, I'll look. So I know you talked at length to his son. Is there anybody alive today who would have been very young who still... Is there anybody alive today that actually met him, that knows him?
One of the people I really enjoyed speaking to was Eustace Rosenberg, who was a professor emeritus at Bard College, and who at the time was a kind of errand boy and message deliverer for Varian Fry. I think he was about 17 when he was in that role, and he had come down to Marseille with Miriam Davenport. She had kind of taken him under her wing. And I had this marvelous conversation with him about how he perceived Varian Fry and about what was going on in the organization at the time. I know that he's writing his own memoir and that one of the chapters in that memoir is going to be very directly about this experience. And so there were certain things that I think he wanted to preserve for his own narrative, but he gave me marvelous details like, you know, what color was the bicycle that he was riding around town and, you know, who was hanging out in the office on what particular day and what they were eating and what people were wearing and how people were talking about each other's personal lives. So it was really, I was really grateful to be able to have that conversation. But there are so many more personal stories that have been preserved by the documentary filmmaker Pierre Sauvage, who's been making a film about Varian Fry for the last 20 years or so.
Wow.
And managed to interview a number of his associates before they died. And so my hope is that sometime within the next few years, we're going to have this, you know, this incredible gift of that documentary that will illuminate this continually unfolding story even further.
So that must have been one of the bikes he borrowed, right? That was the bike he borrowed. To go on the trip.
Yes, that was one of the bikes he borrowed.
So this guy must be like 95 or thereabouts.
Yeah, I think he's 97.
Wow, that's amazing. And so you sat down and spoke with him, right?
Yeah, I talked to him by phone, and you know he was incredibly generous, despite the fact that he, I think, was also protecting some of this information for his own work.
So I guess in conclusion then, and you don't have to answer this if you don't want to, but I see an enormous amount of parallels in the world today that seem to resonate back to that time. Do you?
Yes, and so many more so than existed when I started writing this book. I mean,
right.
When I
10 years ago, right.
Got deep into the project, Obama had just been elected, and... You know, my friends and I, after this election, were just hugging people in the streets of Fort Greene, just thinking, God, everything has now changed. And it would have been a total shock to look ahead to 2016 and to the policies that followed and to understand that actually these ideas about how our own government's restrictions endangered so many lives were not going to be abstract or historical, but were going to be the stuff of, you know, the daily news. So, I mean, I think that that on the more hopeful side, what I guess I would wish for people to take away is that in light of the injustice that Varian Fry observed in his time, he decided to act, and he got out from behind his desk and did what seemed impossible and had a kind of success that, from our perspective, now knowing all of the limitations he faced is kind of inconceivable and miraculous. And so I think, you know, the more I learned about his story and then thought about how we're living now, the more it just felt like, you know, we have an imperative to act. We have an imperative to be politically engaged and stand up for what it is that we believe. And that's what I hope people will be reminded of by learning about his story.
Well, in addition to the fact that America, I think, was to a certain extent, maybe to a great extent, anti-Semitic at this time, at that time, you know, you have the Nazi government, and you also have now Trump basically, I think he did say this, is that, you know, first they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, and then they lose. And that, you know, that seems, you know, I can go back to, you know, Seth Meyers laughing at him or Obama doing what he did. And, you know, it just seems like, wait, we're setting ourselves up for exactly the same situation.
Yeah, but we do have the benefit of being able to examine that history and act on what we've learned. And that is what I hope will happen. You know, there's another election coming up in not too long. And I really hope that everyone is going to get out and vote and is going to, you know, feel galvanized to make a change.
Okay. Well, with that, before I go off on one of my rants, which I do several times a day, and before maybe you go off on a rant, we can close out. And I want to thank you so much. It's a great book. And like I said, you know, having an independent bookstore. Oh, and it's a great cover, too. And
thank you.
And then again, owning an independent bookstore, as many people as tell me, you can't judge a book by its cover. Everybody who comes into my bookstore judges every book by its cover. I can guarantee you that.
Oh, I'm curious. I'm curious to hear what people have been saying about this cover or how they've been reacting to it.
Well,
because there was a lot of discussion about it.
Yeah, I always ask authors that. Well, they just seem to be attracted to it. I haven't asked why are you attracted to it, but, you know, when we have our front table with everything on it, there's just certain books that people, you can see them, they just pick it up. And that's as close as I can come to answering you. But I always ask authors, did you get a chance to vet it? Did you pick it yourself? Did you say, I don't like this one, let's try something else?
Well, there's actually a kind of a secret about this cover that might not be immediately apparent to people coming into the store, but, you know, it's something that you could pass along, which is that the font of the title and of my name on the cover is actually directly pulled from Marc Chagall's own handwriting. And so the cover designer, when she was creating this design for the book, took a look at all of these writings that are available online. You know, you can just see these photographs of Marc Chagall's lettering. And she just grabbed his particular letters and put them together into a font. And so maybe there's just something about his hand, maybe there's something about the way he made marks on a page that really continues to compel us, which I think is so magical, because that was one of the things that was preserved by what Varian Fry did. I mean, so those letters themselves would not probably have existed without Fry's work in France at that time. So I think it's just kind of a marvelous sort of circling of history.
Yeah, I know. And also just the background and that kind of, not fog, but just kind of this feeling of going into the past. But yeah, you know, I was maybe subconsciously, the font just kind of like resonated with me too. But I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's a cool little mini story.
Yeah. Okay, well, thanks again, and it's a wonderful book. I'm sure it will be one of our book club selections once it comes out in paperback, because no one will buy any of my books, hardback books, for book club, even though I try to get them to, but they won't. So when it becomes a paperback, maybe you could Skype into our book club or, you know, something like that.
I would love to do that. Okay. Thank you so much for this conversation. This is really great. I'm so glad we got to talk.
Likewise. Hopefully I'll talk to you soon.
Okay, sounds okay. Great.
Bye-bye. We were talking with Julie Oranger about her book, The Flight Portfolio, which is the story of Varian Gray. And you know, you've heard it all, but the idea is that he saved so many people against so many obstacles, including not only Vichy France, but his own American supposed compatriots. But because of Cordell Hull, the Secretary of State, you know, they only allowed like 200 visas for people. And, you know, all these intellectual, artistic Jewish people that had so much to offer, he had to save as many as he could. And again, it was a difficult situation. It's like King Solomon cutting the baby in half. It's just so hard to pick who are you going to save. You know, I wouldn't want to be in that position. So as I always say, if you join us every week, there's always someone cool here. The upcoming authors I have a bunch of them, but the only one I'll mention is this Mona Awad, who wrote this book, which I don't think I would read unless it was one Rebecca picked. It's called Bunny. So it has a picture of a bunny on the cover. So it's not something a guy would normally pick up and read, but it's really well worth it. You can look at the blurbs on the back. And so I look forward to talking with her about that. And then I'm going to go off on vacation for a while, so there'll be a couple of weeks in which we don't have anyone, or we'll do a rerun or something like that. But as always, you don't have to worry, because if you want to, you just go to Wellington Square Books or the radio station's website, or just simply download our podcasts on iTunes or Podomatic, and then you'll just get, you won't get obviously repeats, you'll just get continuing new stories. So as always, I really appreciate you guys being here. Come by the bookstore, Wellington Square Bookshop, which is just off the Downingtown exit of the Turnpike in Eagle View in the town center, and visit us. Have a cup of coffee with you, and take a look at the store. I would really appreciate it. So again, thanks, and hopefully you'll be here next week when we interview another great upcoming or established writer, author, here on The Avid Reader.